ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here is a wild idea. What if it was already next year? In fact, what if next year actually happened 10 days ago? Okay, so just stay with me. A few years ago, this Australian guy by the name of Matthew Champion, great name, was in the library of Cambridge University, which is exactly as Hogwarts as you imagine it, by the way. Aisle after aisle of these old tomes of knowledge. But one book stood out to Matthew.
So it was actually beautifully bound in a 19th century white leather binding with gold embossing. And when I opened the first pages, there was nothing particularly special about it.
In that book, Matthew saw something that really no one else in history had noticed before. Evidence of someone trying to solve a centuries-old problem with time itself.
And so I knew I was onto something very special at that point. I was extremely excited. I think I probably looked carefully and then I ran out of the reading room just to calm down a little bit before I came back in.
Matthew had that reaction because, frankly, time is in chaos. Minutes are slipping away from us every day. Days, months, years even are ever so slightly lying to you. Yes, New Year's Eve may not even be real. Why? Well, I'm Mark Fennell, and this is a story of moons, of mind-bending maths, some questionable French decision-making, and also a woman named Gertrude. And it's safe to say, no one saw it coming. All right, fam, we are very close. I know you can feel it, I can feel it. Any day now, there will be fireworks, there will be parties, and the calendar page will turn and a new year will begin. Or will it? So I don't know if you know this, but our calendar, as it currently exists, is always and every day just a bit wrong. And I'm saying it in a conspiratorial way because that is very much my shtick. But truth be told, we've known it's wrong since pretty much the days of the ancient Mesopotamians and Babylonians.
Where they did very complex mathematics to understand the shape of what's called the solar year, so that year that aligns with the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. And that comes to about 365.2422 days. Now, that's not a whole number of days, everyone. So there's a bit of a mess there because we're going to have to find some way of making a calendar that over time accounts for the movement of that weird little fraction, that 0.2422.
I'm very sorry for making you think about this much maths close to the end of the year, but technically it's not really my fault. I like to blame Matthew Champion.
I'm an associate professor in history at the University of Melbourne, and I work on the history of people's perception and experience of time.
That is an unusual thing to focus on the history of. Where did you get interested in, this is going to sound weird as I say it out loud, when did you first get interested in time?
I think it was as an undergraduate at university, and I realised I was a historian, so I was constantly thinking about how we related to the past, but I'd never really focused in on the question of time more generally. I thought I'd like to think more about this.
Indeed. Now let us all think more about this. And by this, we mean this problem that if you look at how much time it takes for the Earth to, like, rotate around the Sun, and then you compare it to a calendar, it's just a little bit off. And throughout history, all different kinds of ancient civilizations who have created their version of a year or calendar would notice these, like, problems arising?
Yes, because the seasons would start to wander in those different calendars unless they were aware of it. So that there's some kind of awareness across most cultures that deal with the concept of a year, that there's going to be some shift and some need to insert either extra days in certain years or sometimes extra whole months.
Think about this, right? if you think you know your birthday is going to be on one day, or if we're going to plant a crop together on this day, or there's an essential religious festival or something on another day, and it just keeps shifting from year to year, that must create problems, right?
That's right, and that's why you need timekeepers. You need people with specialist knowledge. You need astronomers, you need mathematicians, people who are observing the movements of the heavens, who are trying to coordinate that movement of the Earth and the Sun, coordinate that with the shape of the seasons.
And so, yes, as you look at a whole host of different civilizations, that becomes something of a profession, right? A timekeeper. But by the time we hit the Middle Ages in Europe, famous for many plagues and crusades, broadly speaking, a lot of these timekeepers seem to lean on just like a few constant tools. And one of the most useful, look up to the sky, is the moon.
Because, of course, it has this regular cycle and people notice that there's the cycle between the full moons and the new moons and that that happens in a regular sequence. So people want to use that structure of the lunar month and coordinate that as a sort of lump of time with the shape of the year. So you can say, in this month is the month I'm going to sow my crop, or in this month is the time that we're going to have a lot of hot weather, or in this month we're going to celebrate a set of religious festivals. So that work of coordinating time between the month and the year and the season to make sure that it stays regular in these coordinated calendars between the sun and the moon, that's the work of these kind of specialist figures in various societies who are given the time to do that thinking, the astronomers, the mathematicians, often the priests.
Now, this is an important detail that Matthew has just alluded to. Priests, religious figures, often ended up with this role of the timekeeper. And it makes sense, right? Because they're the ones that need to tell you when X major religious festival is going to be. And the fact that things go ever so slightly out of sync over time, say the equinox, when the sun is supposed to be directly over the equator, isn't quite when they said it was. Having that be wrong from the religious leader that's also telling me about an absolute God and an absolute hell that I'm absolutely going to, you can see how that schism starts to represent a bit of a threat to the moral power of the church. So the clerics all over the shop go, hang on, guys. Guys, we got a problem here. We need to make sense of how our calendar does not seem to align quite with the reality of what the moon and the seasons are doing.
And so they developed some complex logic here. So they started talking about what's called the legal Easter versus what's called the natural equinox, so the one that you observe with your eyes. And some people were very happy with just keeping those distinctions. They said, fine, it's a legal fiction. Don't worry about it too much.
So basically, some festivals have a very specific date. Others can shift around a bit.
But there were other people who started saying, no, look, this is a bit of a scandal. We actually have to be connected to reality in some way. And so what we've got to do is reform our calendar. And in fact, over the whole life of the church through the Middle Ages, there were very, very clever intellectuals. They were scientists, they were theologians, and they often came up with really creative, interesting responses to the way that they needed to fix that problem of the drift of the equinox and therefore this mismatch between when Easter was being celebrated and what was actually happening in relation to real moons around that spring equinox.
So what does this do for like the major festivals, right? So obviously you've got the birth of Jesus, you've got things like Easter, like it must have an impact on those days as well.
So it doesn't have an impact on things like Christmas, which is a fixed feast that always happens on December the 25th. But Easter is a movable feast.
This is where the phrase comes from.
Exactly. So that term comes from the desire to tie particular feasts for particular celebrations to particular historical events. And the major one, of course, is the Feast of Easter. So that's the feast that celebrates the crucifixion and then the resurrection of Jesus. And the Bible told medieval Christians very clearly that this happened just after the events of Passover in Jerusalem. So Jesus had gone to Jerusalem. That's where he's tried, that's where he's executed, and that's where the Christians believe he rose from the dead. And so they wanted to make sure that this wasn't a fixed day of the year because that wouldn't be connected to Passover. Passover, that Jewish festival, was a movable feast. It was connected to that spring equinox. And so they instituted these series of very strict laws about the calculation of the Easter date. So they said that it had to be on that Sunday just after the full moon following that spring equinox. And that would make sure that it was always connected to Passover in some way. There was always a memory of that initial moment.
Okay, so Easter was literally a movable feast. But couldn't the church have just decided to make it a specific date and stick with it?
They could have fixed the date of Easter on a fixed day of the week, but they decided that there was something so important about that connection with the natural symbolism of light and darkness, with that historical connection to the law of the Hebrews, the Jewish law that they were relating to and trying to find some connection to. So that decision meant that they made Easter this movable feast, and that had implications then for all the other feast days that were going to be arranged and ordered following the Feast of Easter.
And if we were just talking about the big ticket items like your Easters and your Christmases, none of this would have been that big a deal. But actually, the Christian calendar at this time in history, it's loaded with all of these smaller events like random saints' days, and this mixture of fixed and movable feasts results in clashes left, right, and centre.
So if, say, hypothetically, the Feast of St. Gertrude fell on the date that had been determined for Easter, you had a problem because you couldn't properly celebrate Gertrude as well as Easter. So you had to flip Gertrude somewhere else in the calendar to make it work.
And I don't want to live in a world where we don't celebrate Gertrude.
I was not aware of this saint until I started working on this small town in Belgium, and they have a special devotion to Gertrude, and they are very, very kind of cagey about when they're going to move the feast around Easter. So they did special work just for Gertrude.
Okay, so we have this problem where time, literally slipping away from us, the connection between the natural cycles of the seasons and our calculations are a bit out of whack, and now we've got this movable feast of Easter. We don't know when to celebrate Gertrude. If only there was an elegant solution. Which brings us back to that beautifully bound book that we started with.
That's right.
So what exactly was it? Well, let's start by who it was written by.
A particular intellectual, a theologian and philosopher from the University of Leuven, so that's modern Belgium, are working in the 15th century.
Matthew had seen some of this guy's printed books in Brussels, but what he found in the UK had never been widely published for some reason.
I came across this lost manuscript, in essence, in Cambridge, and I thought, well, I'd better understand that, given that I'm the first person to notice this. And it turned out to be all about calendar reform and the maths of the calendar and the complications of the history of the calendar. So suddenly I was thrown into an intense 2-3 months worth of reading to get my head around how our calendars work, how they've come to be the way they are today.
Matthew was the first person to make sense of this 15th century manuscript, and he deciphered it.
I was extremely excited. I can fill in a little piece of the jigsaw puzzle that we hadn't understood before. So it was a feeling that actually we were opening a door to something that was new for us to understand.
The book articulates this problem between observable time, what we can see the stars and moon doing, versus this somewhat controversial and timey-wimey legal time.
It shows that there were clever people trying to resolve this mathematical problem in a pragmatic way. They were trying to make the calendar match what was happening in the natural world. So it turned out that my guy, whose name was Peter Derivo, who was a professor in the theology faculty at the University of Leuven, had decided that he wanted to weigh in on this question, and he wanted to fix this gap between the legal and the observable dates of the equinox. And it was a simple solution. It was just remove 10 days from the calendar. And in fact, that would have solved the problem quite well. And he had a series of predictions then for how he could resolve those other little slippages working up to 700, 800 years in the future. So it was quite a workable solution. It just turned out that it was kind of the wrong time for his solution. He wanted it to work. He wanted it to be communicated to Rome. He wanted it to be announced to all those pilgrims who were going to come to Rome for a special jubilee year, and that would be the way in which this news would flood out across the known world, the known Christian world at that point, and that everyone would then come to the party, they'd delete those 10 days from their calendars, and everything would go on properly as beforehand.
Would it have worked?
Yes, it probably could have worked quite well. It wasn't perfect. There were slightly better mathematical solutions, but it wasn't a bad idea.
And so what happened with this guy's idea?
Basically, it sank like a stone, and we're not quite sure why that's the case. It may have been that Peter was a little bit of an edgy thinker for his time. He'd got involved in some quite difficult debates with one of his colleagues that had been referred to Rome as part of a big series of scandals about whether you could say any true things about the future. So he might have just not been senior enough in the church. Maybe he didn't have the right networks. And you also probably needed the idea to emerge from someone who the Pope had asked to formulate a solution to the idea. And the Pope had not asked Peter to work on this. There was no direction here. He was a guy thinking, I know, this is a good solution, let's go for it. And it just wasn't picked up.
And so it just sort of languishes throughout history, sitting in this book until, you know, you come across it?
Sort of. So there's some evidence that in a controversy that Peter had with actually someone called Paul, Peter and Paul against each other.
It's always Peter and Paul.
A guy called Paul of Middleburg certainly read Peter's texts. He wasn't convinced by them, but he wrote a massively important book that fed straight into the most important calendar reform of modernity, which is the Gregorian calendar reform of 1582, which has full papal backing, which is totally official, and which goes ahead.
Yes. In 1582, Pope Gregory makes the calendar jump from the 4th of October to the 15th of October, which is not a world away from what Peter suggested in his long-lost manuscript that nobody paid attention to. In fact, one might technically argue that Peter did, in fact, see it coming. In any event, we now have the Gregorian calendar. It's the 12 months, 7 days a week situation. It's not perfect. The thing is, it still slips. And people, over the centuries, have still kept trying to solve it, which is what brings you and I to the French Revolution of the 1780s. Yes, they're not just chucking out the monarchy, they're also coming up with bold and frankly bonkers new approaches to the calendar.
Yes, so this is one of the most fascinating new calendars that's ever been invented. It comes about because of that huge controversial revolution of the late 18th century, where the revolutionaries really want to get rid of this old ecclesiastical calendar. They see this as associated with the aristocracy, with the monarchy, with the suppression of the populace. So they are, of course, Enlightenment thinkers. They're deeply interested in reasonable behaviours, in natural observations. So what they propose is they try to have equal months of 30 days each. That still leaves that rather messy 5-6 day period. They give that over to sort of festivals of the revolution at the end of the year. They reform the days of the week. They want a 10-day week. You only get one day off.
Hold on. I thought these were like the, you know, the egalitarian rise up against the emperor types. What are they giving me a 10-day week for with one day weekend? Who approved this?
I think that's one of the reasons that the calendar failed in the end. The other thing
I'd like to address my complaint to Napoleon Bonaparte, please, and thank you.
Well, actually, we can thank Napoleon for ditching that calendar.
I liked him for a reason.
He got rid of it in 1805, basically because it wasn't working. One of the chief areas where it got very confusing was in the length of the day, where you had these kind of 10-hour days with 100 minutes to each hour and 100 seconds to each minute. And that was extremely difficult to make real. So if you imagine, like, how do you make a watch with 100 seconds around that very difficult geometry of the 360-degree circle? So it was really hard to actually make that revolutionary calendar work. And people just kept living by the old calendar. They just kept doing things. So we find in the 18th century in the printed materials, all kinds of books, printed sheets that are coordinating this revolutionary calendar against the old calendar. You're constantly having to do translation work between these two calendars.
Does that mean that, like, there's a bunch of French calendars from like the late 1700s that try and break everything down into like tens that you can like are sitting in an antique shop somewhere?
Yes, you're exactly right. You can find these watches in museums collections. You can find the calendars in print collections in major libraries. The major question, of course, is it rational to think about the number of fingers on your hands as the basis of a calendar, right?
I'm going to go with yes. Sorry, I'm just going to hang on that. That is my thing now. This is my heel I will die on, the cliff I will hold onto with all 10 of my fingers.
The other rather astonishing and bizarre and wonderful thing that the revolutionaries do is they try to get rid of all of those saints' days attached to particular days of the year, and they know they've got to kind of wipe it out with something. So they name days of the year after agricultural implements, like a plough or a hammer, or after farm animals, or after particular agricultural products. And it's quite an insulting process. So for December the 25th, they decide that that's going to be Le Chien, the day of the dog, or the feast of the Annunciation to the Virgin Mary on March the 25th.
I thought the French were good at branding. This is terrible.
Well, it was at least an attempt to kind of create something new. Let's put a positive spin on it. It was an attempt to create something new. It really didn't work. And it didn't work because people remember things, right? And they tie their lives to these kinds of rhythms and habits. And there's no particularly good reason that we should move on from what we're doing currently. It is something that's fully lived by each of us. Our memories are shaped by it. So I sort of sit on the vaguely conservative side here in relation to the calendar. But I think, in fact, it's quite a progressive thought, which is to say we can really connect to our past, to our stories, through these messy, rich histories. We don't have to try to wipe them out. We can live with that complexity, enjoy it, try to understand it, live with the richness it gives to us.
Incidentally, that seven-day calendar that we have now, it is actually older than all of this. It's older than the manuscript, the weird French thing that we should speak less about. In fact, it goes back to those ancient Mesopotamians and Babylonians that we started with.
So the seven-day thing is one of the gifts from ancient Mesopotamia to us. They had a seven-day system of festivals, and that is then what is translated into the Jewish tradition, which comes over to us in the Christian tradition. So, you know, the seven-day story, the myth of creation that you encounter in the book of Genesis, that story of the 6 days where everything gets done and then God rests on the seventh day, the Sabbath, that's what creates the week that's passed on into the Christian tradition and that we still live with today.
So don't mess with the Mesopotamian calendar.
I think that's the answer. They were very clever with their geometry. They were very clever with their mathematics. The seven thing, you know, is it equally divisible into 365.2422? No, it isn't. But you do need to deal with some kind of rhythm of work throughout the week. You need to think about your own body and how it's going to survive in relation to labour. So it was probably quite a sensible idea to have some rest days every now and then in a society that's basically founded around manual labour.
Do you know what's going to kill me, Matthew? In a couple of days' time, I'm going to be smashing a bunch of champagne for New Year's, and this conversation will be playing in my head, and I will be so angry at you.
I'm so sorry.
So, like, when you look back at the different attempts to make our nonsense calendar make sense, particularly the French attempt, like in the 18th century, like, what do you think it tells us about our attempt to rationalize the celestial, the seasonal, the religious, and just like the nonsense that is mathematics? What do you think it tells us?
I think it tells us that as humans, we live with the past all the time and we can't forget it, and it shapes who we are, and that there are really long rhythms of time that are passed over through generations, through our bodies, through our cultures, and that any attempt to get rid of that is kind of a little bit of megalomania. That is, we have to live with who we are in history.
That's lovely. You've actually made sense of this. I suspect this is one of those things that kind of keeps you up at night, because it is like layers upon layers of complexity, right?
Look, it really is. And you have to just keep living and enjoying that complexity. I mean, do you think in Australia there are particular reasons that we should keep thinking about this in interesting ways? We're obviously a product in our time measuring of particular European systems of measuring time. But the seasons that we've been given here
make no sense.
They don't make sense to us, exactly. Whereas if you turn and look at the Indigenous calendar that you've got on your wall or that's down the local primary school, it starts to make sense. You know that we're coming into the season of wattles, for example. If you're out in the bush and you see the wattles flowering, that makes good sense to us. But is that the same as winter? It's not really the same thing. So I do think that if we pay attention to locality and bring that, we could add another layer of complexity. We could just make it even more messy, but also more enjoyable and more sort of connected to the world that we live in around us here. So I think that's one of the things I keep thinking about the history of the calendar is, let's adapt, let's bring in something new to the calendar. We don't have to get rid of the old. In fact, we couldn't really. I think
it would... As evidence is proven over and over again.
Yeah, but we can introduce older knowledge that also can be part of the world around us, that Indigenous knowledge, which is really clear and really direct and makes a lot of sense relates to the world that we live in. You know, a place that I'm very fond of in the Western District of Victoria, the Gunjimara there, have these astonishing calendars where they talk about migration of black cockatoos, they talk about the movement of eels, there's butterfly seasons, and all of these things make sense as soon as you know that landscape, as soon as you've lived there. And I think that it's a way in which we can incorporate and understand and live with the diversity of times. We can have different relationships to our pasts and our futures, and that's something that we should be celebrating, that kind of variety, complexity, but also just plain attention to the world that we live in.
Matthew, thank you so much for taking me through the many layers of time.
A huge pleasure to be here, Mark.
Matthew Champion is an Associate Professor in History at the University of Melbourne. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson. The sound engineer was Hamish Camilleri. I'm Mark Fennell. No One Saw It Coming is made on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. And I'll be back next week, next year, depending on how you interpret your calendar, for a brand new episode. And I will see you then. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.